This morning we're going to be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 8 through 10. 2 Samuel chapters 8 through 10. I'm delighted to have all the boys and girls here in the service today. It's a joy for us to just get together as a whole church family, even though not everybody could be here because of the weather. We're just delighted that those who are here could be here, and those who are here via live stream, we're really glad that you can join us too. So, I'm a little bit like I'm not a thoroughbred, but I feel a little bit like a thoroughbred that got put into the starting gate and then just had to sit there for 2 weeks, you know. So this is one of my favorite passages in all the Bible, 2 Samuel 8 through 10, because it deals with victory. Don't you like victory? It's a really fun thing to preach about, victory. It's something fun to talk about. Defeat isn't so happy, is it? And we've looked at some of David's defeats up to this point, haven't we? The humility of being chased around by Saul, of having no place to go, of literally running to the enemies of God in order to find a place where he might be able to stay alive. I don't know that that settles in on us enough to recognize just how defeated David felt. And we would need to read the Psalms carefully, and we went through several of them, haven't we, about just how low he got in his feeling of defeat. When I was in the sixth grade, I was a part of a fifth and sixth grade basketball team that was about the worst team that has ever been assembled. We didn't win a game that year, and for some reason, we got scheduled to play the seventh and eighth grade team from the city of Peoria that was the city champions and had not lost a game all year. We lost that game. Now, mind you, this is 6-minute quarters, okay? So it's 24 minutes of basketball. We lost that game 104-8. Now, in grade schools, they don't have 3-digit scoreboards, so it looked like we won 8-4. I can still remember the article in the Peoria Journal Star about that game. It said, McKinley completed an undefeated season last night with a 104-8 victory over Norwood. 12-year-old Bobby Humbles led McKinley with 58 points. We were bad, okay? 2 years later, same school, I was on an eighth grade team that was undefeated, never lost a game. There's humility and victory. And this is, I don't mean to compare my little, junior high exploits to David, but this is the nature of life, okay? It's how life is. There's defeats and there are victories. And how you handle the defeats determines what happens in achieving the victories too. There's a connection there. So we're going to look at 2 Samuel 8, and we're going to see David's victories and administration shows the organization of spiritual victory. Now, we have to think first of all about the larger geopolitical picture. What that means is, what's going on in the entire region of the Middle East? Did you know that Mesopotamia, way up in the north, and Egypt, way in the south, were the two great superpowers? They're the two great superpowers. And Israel and all the other peoples around, the Philistines and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Amalekites and the Syrians, all those people are just little tiny players on the stage. If you want to use an illustration, the people of Israel and the Philistines and the Ammonites and Moabites, they're mice, okay? They're mice. And Egypt and Babylon or Assyria or Persia or whoever's in charge in Mesopotamia, Those people are the cats, okay? And so you can say the saying, when the cat's away, the mice are gonna play, right? So what was happening in David's time, it just so happened that the cats were in internal turmoil. Egypt was a total mess politically. Mesopotamia was a total mess politically. And so neither of them had any influence on the region. So what happens? All of the local powers start to fight each other for control. And David, in 2 Samuel 8, emerges as the victor in this local conflict. He is the biggest mouse of the mice. Okay? Now, here's a question for you. Who's in charge of every kingdom? It's God, isn't it? Yeah, God's in charge of every kingdom. So who was it that determined that the people of Mesopotamia were going to be in a mess when David became king? Who was it who determined that the people in Egypt were going to be a mess when David became king so that he could expand his kingdom? It was God. God is in charge of every kingdom of this world. The Egyptians have their problems. The Mesopotamians have their problems. While the cat's away, the mice are going to play. And God allows this period to be a time when there are no superpowers so that he can bring David victory. So let's look at the chapter now. Chapter 8, verse 1. After this, David defeated the Philistines, subdued them, and David took Meth-Egama out of the hand of the Philistines. The defeat of the Philistines is stated in one sentence. Now, this is no small feat. Just, oh yeah, and by the way, he defeated the Philistines. This has been going on for chapter after chapter, this battle. And all of a sudden, it's just summarized. And David defeated the Philistines. Verse 2, and he defeated Moab and measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. Two lines he measured to be put to death, one full line to be spared, and the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. So the defeat of the Moabites. These are his brothers, right? Because you remember Ruth was a Moabitess, okay? In fact, in 1 Samuel 22, David had gone into Moab and asked for protection for his mother and father until he knew how things were going to turn out between him and Saul. Here's something to note about the Middle East. It's true all over the world, but it's particularly true in the Middle East. Allies and enemies change and shift. Your enemy today may be your friend tomorrow, and your friend today may be your enemy tomorrow. Did we learn that in Afghanistan? You know, we were supplying the Taliban with weapons in the war against when they were fighting Russia, and now we're at war. See, your friend is your friend today, maybe your enemy tomorrow. That's just the way it is in the Middle East, okay? David was no threat to Moab when he was on the run anyway, but now that he's the king of Israel, there is a threat. And they're trying to control the trade that's over on the other side of the Jordan River, just like David's trying to control the trade routes. And this statement here, where he measures two lines of Moabites and a third line, and two of them are killed, and one is not, killing two-thirds of the army of the Moabites, boy, that sure seems kind of cruel, doesn't it? It's a statement of fact here, not a statement of either approval or disapproval. And additionally, the Moabites are described elsewhere as very immoral, sacrificing their children to their god, Moloch or Chemosh. And finally, I get the sense that verse 2 is descriptive as an act of mercy rather than cruelty, because David spares a third of them when the usual plan in the Middle East was to kill them all. So, what that means is that the east in Moab and the west in Philistia, those boundaries are secure. Let's look at verses 3 through 10, and there's the conquest of the region to the north. David defeated Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah, when he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. He's going way up north. And David took from him, gives a list of horsemen and soldiers, and he hamstrung the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. The hamstringing of horses meant that they could continue to be used as farm animals, but couldn't be used as military weapons. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, David struck down 22,000 men of the Syrians. David put garrisons, so he's putting up forts up north in Aram of Damascus. The Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute, just like the Moabites. Now he's getting money from their trade. And notice the end of verse 6. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Beton, from Berothai, cities of Hadadezer, David took very much bronze. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer, Toi sent his son Joram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him. For Hadadezer had been at war with Toi, and Joram brought with him articles of silver, of gold, and of bronze. So what's happening is enemies of his enemy are now friends of David, and they're coming and bringing presents to David for all this. And this is the greater region to the north, a treaty agreement with Hamath, which is way, way up in the north. Verses 13 and 14. And David made a name for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. And he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom, he put garrisons. And all the Edomites became David's servants. Notice this sentence. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. So we get to verse 12, which is haven't read yet. And I want to show you this map because it's going to be a descriptor. Verse 12. From Edom, that's down here in the southeast, Moab to the east, the Ammonites, the Philistines over here in the west, Amalek, that's in the south, and from the spoil of Hadadezer, king of Rehob, that's way up here. So all of this is David's summary in verse 12 of his conquests. All around, while the cat's away, the mice play. And verse 12 says, David is the biggest cheese. He has become the controller of this whole region. And that twice it's said so far now, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. If you'll look at verse 6, the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. Verse 11, these also King David dedicated to the Lord. And then verse 14, the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. This is a description that David sees that this victory is not his, it is God's. It's not his. It's God. It's not his kingdom. It's God's kingdom. Isn't it fascinating that it just so happened that the superpowers are nowhere to be found when there is a man who seeks God's kingdom first? Verse 15 through 18, so David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub and Abimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests, and Seraiah was secretary. You've read some of this in your First Chronicles reading, as we've been reading through the Bible, right? Aren't you glad for the recording guy who can pronounce the words for you? And Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were priests. Notice, it's one thing to conquer. It's another thing to win the peace. And these verses describe how David wins the peace. Justice and equity to all the people. It's not based on geography, not based on proximity to David. It's not based on one family or tribe. It's based on David's relationship to the Lord. And notice the government officials. as they are described. First, verse 16, is defense, the Department of Defense. Joab was over the army. That's David's sister's son. That's his nephew. Records is second. Did you see it? Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was the recorder. Isaiah 62:6 says, "On your walls, O Jerusalem, I have set watchmen all day, all the night. They'll never be silent. You who put the Lord in remembrance, take no rest." And then it says, "the recorder," the one who remembers, literally. The recorder is the one who keeps the king informed, advised, and communicates the king's wishes to others. The Lord has recorders who remind the king of his promises and intentions until they're completed. This is what we're doing when we pray. Your kingdom come, your will be done. We're reminding the Lord of what he's going to do. Priests is mentioned next, the worship of God. A secretary is mentioned. Why? To establish justice over the preservation of property rights, the one who writes down the decisions that are made. And then you have the Kerethites and Pelethites, that's the secret service. And then there's Benaiah as the head of the secret service. It's mentioned at the very end there, David's sons were priests. David's sons, priests, weren't the Levites only supposed to be the priests? Well, it's likely that this verse is only to connect the priesthood in relations with the crown. The kings were not to usurp the priestly role. That's what got Saul into trouble anyway. And so it's not really possible to think that David would make the same error. The idea is that they were working with the priests. How do we apply this David's victories and administration showing the organization of spiritual victory? How do we apply that to our lives? Let me share with you three. One, God, just as he was in David's day, is in charge of geopolitics. The quietness of Egypt and Mesopotamia at the time was God's doing. Our job is primarily not to change geopolitics. Our job as God's people is to be God's people and watch him change geopolitics for his purposes. That said, it's important to note that David was a man who fought for what was right. So should we. This requires wise strategy and tactics, and we ought to be excellent thinkers and planners, just as excellent in the execution of those kinds of plans as David's mighty men were. But we need to keep in mind that it is not by our plans that the victory occurs. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. And all of these matters foreshadow, do they not, the coming rule of Jesus Christ. He will be God who brings victory and King, the one who executes the plans at the same time. Isn't that a beautiful thing to look forward to? So now we come to chapter 9. And we see David's grace to Saul's son shows the selfless nature of spiritual victory. Now, the general plan, whenever you took over as a king, was to wipe out any person that was associated with the prior regime. There's good reasons for this, aren't there? To prevent anyone in the future usurping the throne. If we're going to be pained over why David killed 2/3 of the Moabite army, let us also puzzle over how this was actually gracious and why he allowed people from the Saul family and government to remain alive. Verse 1, David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" David seeks out Saul's family in order to show kindness. This is unheard of. Please, let that settle in. It's not known in the Middle East. It's not how ancient Near Eastern kings worked. Verses 2 through 4, a conversation with a guy named Ziba. Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." The king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? Notice that, the kindness of God to him. Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "He's in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodabar." Then David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodabar. It's a conversation with Ziba, a servant in the house of Saul, who shouldn't be alive either. Now, I don't want to spoil a future story, but you need to know that this Ziba and David's son Mephibosheth are going to become a thorn in David's side later. He spares them, but the reason why people didn't spare was to save trouble later, and David sparing them will give him trouble later. I know, you should cry about that. It is sad. Verse 6. Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, paid homage, and David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold, I'm your servant." David said to him, "Do not fear, for I'll show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." This restoration of family property rights and to be able to be in the king's inner circle, that's a huge deal. And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" Dogs in the Middle East are not thought of as pets. They're scavengers. And so they're almost always described in the Bible in negative terms in the Old Testament. And that's how Mephibosheth, I'm just a wandering stray mutt here. How would you show this kindness to me? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, said to him, "All that belonged to Saul, to all his house, I have given to your master's grandson, and you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at the king's table like one of the king's sons, and Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. So you get the picture. Ziba has now been given the job of being a steward, a foreman over Mephibosheth's properties, which have been granted him from the old Saul properties that now all belong to him. And Mephibosheth stays in Jerusalem, sitting at the king's table, while Ziba takes care of Mephibosheth's businesses, right? Related to his property. Ziba and his family become Mephibosheth's servant. Mephibosheth always had close access to the king. To eat at the king's table was a trusted spot in the Middle East. It meant that you were trusted. This access also gave you status, prestige, and influence. What are we to make of this? How do we apply this kind of grace to Saul's son, to our lives? Well, here's a question for you. Where should you seek out to show grace when no one expects you to do so? Did you know that that is a mark of the Christian, the one who follows the true God? A person who shows grace when no one expects it. When nothing about the cultural standards would cause you to do it, you're just showing grace. That's what David did, and it seems to me that it is always the mark of God's people everywhere and at all times to show such grace. Doing this, showing grace when no one expects you to do so, reveals that you live by a different standard. You are different. Another application, salvation. And boy, Mephibosheth's life was saved, wasn't it? Salvation is always by grace when we enter into relationship. It is not on the basis of works. How much farming could Mephibosheth do to help David? Answer, nothing. David could do nothing to merit, or Mephibosheth could do nothing to merit David's favor. And it's a picture, is it not, of what eternal salvation is like. So now we come to chapter 10. David's triumph over Ammon and Syria show courage for spiritual victory. David's foreign policy was one of trying to make friends to enable trade to flourish in the region. This didn't always happen in David's time, but his decisions ended up allowing for that kind of prosperity to happen in his son Solomon's reign. And so in verses 1 and 2, you have the sending of an entourage to join in the funeral services and in of an Ammonite king and in the coronation of a new Ammonite king. Look what it says. After this, the king of the Ammonites died. Anun, his son, reigned in his place. David said, I'll deal loyally or kindly with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. Basically, he's sending an entourage to join in the mourning and to be a part of the coronation. Verse 3, there's some young Turks in the Ammonite, by young Turk, I don't mean that nationally, I mean that metaphorically. These young guys that think they know better, right? The princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he's honoring your father? And I'll put in a little Burkle thing. Ha! Has not David sent his servants to search the city to spy it out and overthrow it? They're saying, no. I think David's trying to get you. That's what's going on here. So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips. Do I need to show that? Cut off the garments at the hips, right? It's a way of embarrassing, okay? And sent them away. These young guys, privy council, determined that David is up to no good. And so they are going to cut off half their beards and cut off the backsides of their garments. The shame that's associated with this immodesty and the outward virtues of manliness is evident. Look at verse 5. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. By the way, there's two kinds of cultures. There's shame-based cultures and guilt-based cultures. And sometimes the reason why we don't understand the Middle East is because we live in a guilt-based culture and they live in a shame-based culture. And it'd be wise for you to Google that sometime and just see that there's differences between shame-based cultures and guilt-based cultures. Anyway, they're shamed because of their immodesty and because of the outward virtues of manliness that they've lost. And so what David says is, when it was told David, he sent to meet them. The men were greatly ashamed. The king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. let me just stop the story here by saying that the issue of manhood is a huge, hotly debated one today. Everywhere from the controversy over a Gillette commercial to the pronouncements of the American Psychological Association about a week ago related to manhood, we simply don't have a clue as a culture about what manhood is about. We just don't know. And so, there are, in every culture, things that identify men as men. And cultural manhood can be good or bad, right? There's ways that in a culture you can, that's the way you're identified as a man, and it can be bad. There's other ways that it could be, and it's good. And there's other things that are just neutral. They aren't good or bad. For example, if culturally men are to be quiet, brooding, angry types who boss women around by being physically stronger than them and who bully all those who are weaker than them, that's a cultural manhood that stinks. It's wrong, right? However, if culturally men should wear beards, that is neither moral nor immoral. It simply is. And in Israelite culture, the wearing of a beard was a description of cultural manhood, not biblical. Don't take from this, guys who are clean shaven here, don't take from it, oh man, I guess I better grow a beard. And don't guys who are bearded take from this, oh man, I'm sure glad I'm holy because I have a beard. Don't do that. That's why we had the little fun Facebook thing a couple weeks ago where I was standing next to Josh, right? In thinking about this whole thing about manhood, let me give you a little bit of a... can I give you a little history of beards in Israel? Okay, so this is a picture, believe it or not, from an obelisk by Shalmaneser III, the king of Assyria, and this guy right there, that is King Jehu. It's about 840 BC, okay? And Jehu was defeated by Shalmaneser III, and you notice that Jehu is wearing what? A beard, okay? He's a bearded guy. There's all kinds of things we find out from these reliefs. This is a picture from Ramses II in Egypt, about 1273 BC, and these are Hebrew, wait a minute, back up. This is still from Shalmaneser III, and these are Hebrew guys that have been captured. And notice they're carrying harps and they're wearing beards, okay? So that's 840 BC. Now, here's the Ramses II war scenes on the south wall at Karnak. And so this is 1273 BC, and he captured Hebrews in his war. And here they are, okay, guys coming up, and you'll notice that they're all wearing beards, and you'll see that even in ancient times, Egyptians who culturally didn't like beards, didn't wear beards, that they've even chiseled off the beards of the Hebrew guys, just chopping them off because it's not a manly thing in Egypt to have a beard, you see. This comes from Beni Hassan, which is a painting in a tomb that dates back to the time of Abraham, and these are Amorites, Westerners, from which Abraham was one of that family of Amorites, and you'll notice that the women are not wearing beards, and the men are wearing beards, and the children are not wearing beards, okay? So from Abraham all the way through David's time to 200 years after David in the time of Jehu, what is it that marked culturally that Hebrew men were men? They wore beards, okay? And so you have all kinds of things that happen in church history. For example, the Fourth Council at Carthage, AD 398, the clergyman shall not let his hair grow, I'm obeying, neither shall he remove his beard. Oops, I'm disobeying, right? Charles Spurgeon, in his lecture to my students, grow your beards, a habit most natural, scriptural, manly, and beneficial. Augustine, the beard signifies the courageous, the earnest, the active, the vigorous. What is it? It's a cultural convention, okay? If you want to know, by the way, men, why it is that we don't grow beards, it really boils down to what happened about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, when they figured out that tuberculosis bacteria was harbored in men's beards, and there was a huge public health campaign to get men to shave as a way of saying that they were careful not to spread germs, you know. And so you look at the line of presidents, beard, 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 all of a sudden, no beard, no beard, no beard, you see. It's a cultural issue, neither right nor wrong, okay. But in Israel, time, out of mind, for centuries, that was the way in which men demonstrated that they were men. Question. Is that the only way Hebrew men were demonstrating that they were men? Was it not also in the way in which they were following their leader David to bring comfort to a foreign king who'd lost his dad? Was it not also in their ability to follow David into the battlefield and to win those battles? It seems to me that there's way bigger fish to fry than the issue of outward appearance. And it seems to me that we in our culture have lost, even within the Christian community, have lost a sense of what it means to be a man. So often, we just get it by osmosis, by whatever environment we happen to grow up in. I was fortunate in that I grew up in the family of a very godly man who I knew just instinctively how to be a man from, because he was a great model and example. Other men do not have such examples. And so it becomes very important, does it not, for the Christian community to really serve to point out how do we help young men to be men, godly, Christ-following, God-honoring men? Is it just by outward appearance, like whether you wear a beard or not? I think that's kind of a shallow thing. Rather, let's be known by those virtues that we see in the fruit of the Spirit and in Scripture. Well, in verses 6 through 8, the Ammonites hire the Syrians to help them fight their battles for them. Cowards have others fight their battles for them. In verses 9 through 14, we have General Joab, who divides his army and he gains the victory. Was this brilliant strategy? Well, maybe. But like much of the fog of war, victory is more because of belief in the battle plan and in God bringing the victory rather than the brilliance of the battle plan. People always study battles and they go, he did a brilliant thing, he divided his army and won. And then there's another story, you go, he did a horrible thing, he was so stupid, he divided his army and he lost. You go, well, is it right or is it wrong to divide your army? Well, it all depends on how it turned out, right? And in verse 12, Joab tells us why his battle plan is a good one. Be of good courage and let us be courageous for our people. This is the mark of Hebrew manhood, the issue of courage, belief in the battle plan, taking courage in who you are as a team. But more than that, look at the second thing. Let us be courageous for our people, for the cities of our God, who we're fighting for, and may the Lord do what seems good to him, a trusting in God for the outcome. That, it seems to me, is a huge picture of what is biblical manhood. To fight for our people, to fight for the cities of our God, to believe in God's battle plan, and then mostly to trust the sovereignty of God. May the Lord do what seems good to him. In verses 15 through 19, we learn General Douglas MacArthur's maxim, in war, there is no substitute for victory. David responds to the gathering of the Syrians, and by pressing the battle after the initial victory was won, David wins a peace that will last for about 50 years. And if it had not been invited by stupid moves on the part of Israelite kings, that peace could have lasted for over 150 years. Look at verse 19. The power of victory to prevent further war. When all the kings who were the servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subjected to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. That is, they're not going to battle with the Israelites anymore. We've learned that lesson. In war, there's no substitute for victory, for by winning a victory, it prevents further wars. We can see that illustrated throughout history, can we not? So, here's the application for this section. It's a question. Where will the men of courage come from in this hour? In this moment, where it has stopped being a cultural blessing for you to call Jesus Lord. It used to be, culturally, actually a good thing. A man was a nice, respected Christian man, right? Used to be respectable. Now, it's regarded as you are homophobic, you are a person who doesn't care about others, you are insisting on your way, you are mean and ugly. That's what the culture thinks of when it hears the term Christian man. Will, men, you be courageous to say, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ? For it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes it. Second question, and this is one that I'm not sure I have all the answers for in this hour. What does it mean to be courageous at this moment in time? To be sure, it can mean to stand up and to believe things that the tide of the culture is going against. But I also think that it means that we have a trust in God, a trust in Him that's beyond just, Lord, make things happy and pleasant for me. Lord, make me prosperous and successful. It goes beyond that to say, Lord, let me make a difference in my world for Jesus Christ. Now, there's going to be times in that where you're courageous and you lose 104-8. And there'll be other times where you're courageous and you win and you're undefeated and it just looks like success everywhere. Did you know that David was the same person in defeat and in victory? He was the same man because he was God's man, seeking to build God's kingdom, not his own. Let that be true of us as well. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you for these chapters that reveal to us the nature of David's trust in you. And here we rejoice in the victories. And Lord, help us to rejoice in the victories we experience as men and women who are followers of Jesus Christ. But Father, help us just as well in the times of defeat to trust you, to be able to say along with General Joab, may the Lord do what seems good to him. Lord, I pray that if there's anyone here who's never put their faith and trust in Christ, that they'd know that that's the beginning step of walking with you, of what it means to be a godly man or woman, to recognize that we're broken by our sin. We cannot save ourselves. Our good works are worthless. And you've sent one, the God-man, Jesus Christ, to come to this world to die on the cross to pay for our sin. And whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. So, Lord, make that truth real to everyone. Help us in this week to be courageous men and women for you. And help us to seek your face as to exactly what that means, moment by moment. In Jesus' name, amen.